No propaganda, no lies, and definitely no BS. You're with George Eliason on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
This is TNT Talk Radio. I'm your host, George Eliason. Welcome back. Now, I realize there's a lot of confusion about Ukraine, not just about the war itself, but who's actually there? What's going on? Are there Nazis there for real? I mean, where'd they come from? And why are people calling Ukrainians Nazis to begin with? I mean, honestly, in terms of what you can call a country, I think that would be about the worst insult possible, don't you? Well, I want to take the mystery out of this because no one had a reason to know where Ukraine actually was until recent events took shape. And when Ukraine came out of the gate and became an international issue and always in the media, it was a very dangerous and scary prospect and a very dangerous thing. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, the world's on the brink of nuclear war. NATO's on the brink of mobilizing. Russia had to mobilize in a military operation. But who were they defending? Weren't those people Ukrainian? What's going on here? Why would Russia do that? Well, to understand this, you have to go back and understand who the players actually are. And how things developed and why they got so out of hand. And they are out of hand. Now, this is only part of the history, okay? But if you get an overview, this will make it a lot easier to understand and talk about. Now, I want to give you a couple of quotes. It's from Waffen SS Galician officer. His name is Leonid Mukha, and this is from May 2009. Now, Leonid Mukha thought of himself as a great Ukrainian. He served in World War II. He was in the Waffen SS serving the Germans, fighting, he said, the Soviet Union. But were they? And we'll cover those bases too. Now, in 2009, his view of the people of Ukraine, who are Ukrainians, will give you an idea of who the Ukrainians are. You see, it didn't start out as a nationality. It started out as a political concept. And it didn't start in what's now Ukraine. These ideas were formed in a region called Galicia that was part of the Habsburg Empire. Now, the Habsburg Empire was at the end of their run, and things were getting pretty stale there. And they were worried they were going to lose the empire. It was going to crumble within if they didn't do something. The Russian Empire, right next door, was actually attractive to their people. And so they came up with this plan. After they freed the serfs, they decided that they would create an area called Ukraine within the Habsburg Empire called Galicia. And it would always stay part of the Habsburg Empire. But the Galicians would do a propaganda drive and talk to the Russians next door and coax them into wanting to join them. They would be an independent Ukraine. Now, we're talking about Russian people in Russia here. Where did all that start? Why did the Habsburgs think they could take over part of Russia this way? When you go back in history, all the way back to the Kiev Rus, which is what Ukraine today fights about with Russia all the time. The Kiev Rus actually began in a city called Novigrad, in what's now Russia. And they moved the capital down to Kiev. Better location, a lot more central, closer to the trade routes, etc. It was win-win-win. Now, from there, they actually started two other capitals, regional. One was in Belarus, and the other was an area all the way over by what is now Poland. It was called Halicz and Volodymyr. That was a provincial capital of the Kiev Rus Empire. Well, why is this important? Well, Halicz and Volodymyr, they started marrying into the European royalties, and Kiev wasn't too crazy about this because they were pulling away. So they went down, fought with them, beat them back into line, and went back to Kiev. But as the city itself, Kiev, started weakening in terms of influence, the centers started moving away from it. One of them went to Moscow. Belarus was standing up on its own, and so was Halicz and Volodymyr, which became Galicia. They married into the Austrian kingdom, hoping to take that over, and went European and stepped away from the Kiev Rus in terms of where things went politically and in terms of nationality from that point on. Now, it doesn't mean that they're, you know, they're a totally different people, but they think differently. The Galicia region grew up inside the Austrian Empire, and the different kingdoms that formed before the Austrian Empire were always protective of the name because they wanted to use that as a springboard to take the rest of the Kiev Rus lands. And this is what the Habsburg Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, was after. And they thought they could do it by, one, freeing them, two, giving them political rights and representation, and we're still talking about Galicia, three, sending the Galicians across the section of Russia, telling them we're all one people, because, well, by that point, Russian civilization had developed into Russian civilization. There was no need to call back to something else at that point. The Tsars had been in power for hundreds of years, just like the Habsburgs, and everybody there, all the people within the empire, were considered Russian. During World War I, the Galicians, the Habsburgs, tried to increase their empire by taking what's now Ukraine. Now, towards the end of World War I, they actually cut a deal. Them and the German Empire cut a deal with a guy named Vladimir Lenin. And they said, Vladimir, we're going to support your revolution because we need Tsarist Russia out of the picture in this war. This is World War I and Russia's beating them up. Lenin says, well, if you support my revolution, what do you want? And they said, we want the Kiev Rus lands. We want to call that Ukraine and make it an independent Ukraine. And Lenin said, okay, that's great. So they supported and they made the Bolshevik revolution successful. Now, why would they do that? Because after that, everybody really didn't like socialism. Well, that's not quite true. Socialism dominated most of Europe all the way through World War II. Nationalist socialism was the politic of even Germany, Italy, fascism, as its root, and the body of it is in socialism. These were anti-Bolshevik socialisms. They were different because they were nationalist. All nationalist politics generally revolve around the same types of socialism. And Ukraine today, at the bottom, while the top of the politics is fascist, the bottom underneath is very, very socialist still. It's just the way it works. And we'll get to why that is shortly. Now, so World War One ends, but the Germans lose. Right before that happened, the Soviet Union signed the Treaty of Brest with Germany and Austria. One of the secret provisions was that Ukraine would be free. They would recognize it, and that would be that. It would be a country. Well, when the Allies beat Germany and Austria, they nullified the Treaty of Brest. And back in Moscow, all the other Bolshevik leaders weren't too happy about Lenin doing this to begin with. And because the treaty had been declared void by the Allies, they said, we're not going to honor it. We got what we want. We don't need to give you anything. And we're keeping this place called Ukraine. And it was Vladimir Lenin that actually named it Ukraine. And I think he did it to appease these nationalists over in what was the falling apart Austrian Empire. So he was trying to appease them on that count, and he started breaking off other parts of Russia that he considered maybe problematic to me, or they may help me later on to get these people in line. And that's how Donbass became a part of Ukraine. Donbass is where the personal guards to the czars came from up until the revolution, so he wanted to punish them anyway. Now, so we go through all this thing, and they try to start a country called Ukraine on Russian territory. And they're running around telling all the people that live there, okay, you're Ukrainians, remember? We're all Ukrainians. And guess what? They said, no, we're not. We're Russians. Well, these Ukrainians from Galicia, which was the Austrian Empire, thought, really, you want to be Russian after all this? So they proceeded to have what's called a pogrom. They tortured and murdered over 300,000 people in 1 year, trying to persuade the Russians that were in what became Ukraine, that they were Ukrainian. They didn't have any success with that. They never had any support with that. So the Soviet Union kept what was Ukraine, and the people were a little bit resentful for Lenin changing their nationality like that, because they were Russian. Now, I'm going to skip forward to 2009, and then we're going to go back to World War II. Now, this is from a Waffen SS Galician officer. His name is Leonid Mucha. In 2009, and this is how many years after the Soviet Union fell in 1991, there is a Ukraine. It is separate from the Soviet Union. It is its own thing. So you'd think this guy would be happy after all that. He'd recognize, well, these Ukrainians are, well, they're my people, right? That would be the normal thing to do. No. What he had to say about it was, it's incredibly revealing. Relative to the USSR or Russia, it's time to make friends with Russian or Jewish or vice versa. Read the Gold Party to be out of suspicion or to prove your loyalty to the international ruling regime. He's talking about the Soviets, well, what was left of it, and the bankers. Now, relative to the faith, the issue is even more acute here. Is the Russian Orthodox Moscow patriarchate canonical, or is it lies in the bones to keep the lush peace, the believers of Ukraine, which nevertheless failed to destroy so much as the believers of Russia? We nevertheless have not succumbed to all the Russification. Wherefore, that our able-bodied people help us in this. So think of Ukrainians, Cock Lee, the little Russians, as well as some Russians and all of foreigners. Now, he's making a difference between the little Russians and Ukrainians. The Ukrainians came from Galicia, and that's actually where this man came from. That's where the army was formed he fought for. And then he mentions the Cock Lee, which is a derogatory term for the little Russians. Well, why did they call them little Russians to begin with? Russia exists on two continents, Asia and Europe. Russia Magna, the big part of Russia, is in Asia and covers quite a lot of it. Russia Minor is in Europe, and that is the part that became Ukraine. So when they made the differentiation of little Russians, what it was is saying, okay, I know you're from this region. You're saying the region, your European part. Now, he also made another statement on this. And this is also very revealing. Now, this is an officer of the Waffen-SS Galician who served Germany, who murdered, was part of, as you'll see shortly, an army that murdered over 5.5 million of the people that he said was his countrymen and what became Ukraine. Why did you join the Galicia division was the question he was asked. He said it was a call of the heart, as well as hundreds of thousands of true patriots who gave their lives in a struggle for Ukraine's independence. I cannot understand the actions and logic of all the little Russians, the Cock Lees, who speak in another's language and so hate all that is Ukrainian. Why is it every nation, every state trying first to have a strong, capable, and well-trained army? It's the key to independence and sovereignty. We have this sovereignty thanks to the quarrels of our little tricks. The little Russians lost more than 300 years ago and got into the Moscow bondage from which till now we cannot scramble them out of. During the years of independence, a lot's been done. A young, patriotic, but inept and still uncompromising generation in which we see our youth, a great desire to have the Ukrainian state, and it's not the Ukrainian state, but it grows up. In relations with the enemy, we must be consistent and adequate. Why do we have to love the enemy who hates us so fiercely? Without a modern combatant and most importantly, patriotically educated army, we will not have anything. The army cannot be bilingual. The patriot will not speak in another language. If there are Russian legionnaires in it, they should be separated into separate units and settled in the Chernobyl zone. For example, in Germany, they did this to my son. Now, really think about this statement. The amount of hate, this is 2009. He's not saying this in 1941 or 1945. Ukraine has existed. They built the country just how they like, okay? Any way they want to build it, they can build it. But the hate and rage he feels for the average citizen of Ukraine is enormous. And this is the hate and rage that goes on today. This is how Kiev looks at the average Ukrainian. This is how the army looks at the average Ukrainian. And this will also explain why, when you hear stories of torture, murder, etc., in Ukraine, now they try to, you know, use their dirty tricks and pawn it off on others like Russians or Donbass or whatever. But they're getting rid of their enemies. Kiev right now is using the war to take people that are Russian descent, speak Russian, have half a day of training, throw them on the front line into a meat grinder because it's their way of getting rid of the enemy. It's not Moscow that's the enemy in that case. The enemy of the nationalists is the enemy within. It's the enemy that can change your government or slow down its progress from the direction you want it to go. And that is the people that refuse to speak Russian. And in 2009, he was complaining that Kiev was totally Russified, totally Russified. Well, until 2014, and even now, most politicians can't speak Ukrainian fluently. The city spoke Russian because it's Russian people. So what all of this has done is not just drive a wedge between Ukraine and Russia, it's destroying the internals of Ukraine itself and what actually made it a good country. And it was. Now, we're going to take a break, and I'll see you right after it. This is George Eliason with TNT Talk Radio.
Misty Winston on TNT Radio.
We are joined this hour by Andy Worthington, who is the foremost expert on Guantanamo. And we are discussing the significance of the WikiLeaks Guantanamo files. If Julian Assange is being persecuted and potentially extradited, facing 175 years in prison for doing something that we know that the New York Times and The Guardian also did.
Well, I mean, it makes absolutely no sense to me, Misty, that they've singled out Julian. The situation that we're left with is that all of these other media outlets, all of them, you know, like dozens and dozens of newspapers from across Europe and the United States and around the world, all published the information that was made available by Chelsea Manning, and yet only one person is under the threat of a prosecution that could lead to him spending the rest of his life in prison. It absolutely doesn't make sense.
Misty Winston on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Interview conducted at 10:15. Present are Sergeant Jones, PC Clough, Mr. Wall, an uninsulated cavity wall, and his solicitor, Mr. Bent. Do you understand the charges?
I shall be speaking for Mr. Wall on account of him being a pile of bricks.
Right, you're accused of wasting energy, Mr. Wall, and we've got concrete evidence. We know that unfilled cavity walls are responsible for up to a third of all home energy wastage.
We also believe you're involved in a fencing operation.
We're going to throw the book at you.
Okay. Mr. Wall would like to say ouch.
It's criminal to waste energy. To find out how to save up to 25% off your heating bills, visit saveenergy.co.uk or call 0845 727 7200.
Mama, what does the chicken say? Dog. Cat. Giraffe.
Giraffe, really? Giraffe.
You're not going to get it all right. Just make sure you nail the big stuff, like making sure your kids are buckled correctly in the right seat for their age and size. Get it right.
Visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat.
Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
This is today's News Talk and the voice of freedom, TNT Radio.
This is TNT Talk Radio. I'm your host, George Eliason. Welcome back. Now, I'm going over some quoted material from a Waffen SS, an SS Galician officer, Leonid Mucha. And they're the actual real Ukrainians, because these are the real Ukrainians. It's not the people that live there, by the way. How they actually feel about the people that live in Ukraine. And we're talking about the average Ukrainian that wants to live, have a better life, and maybe isn't political or very political, or anyone that isn't a nationalist. Now, when he said that, "I cannot understand the actions and logic of all the little Russians, the Khakhlis, who speak in another's language and so hate all that's Ukrainian." All the people that lived here. Now, I was here in 1991, and the customs haven't changed. The folk customs that have been here celebrating their culture for centuries have not changed. So whose culture is he talking about? Who do they hate? Who are they defining as Ukrainian? He's talking about the Galicians and the people that were out of the Habsburg Empire. Now, at the beginning of the quote, he actually lists them, and he calls them the national division of the division, or these are the ethnic Ukrainians. It was mostly staffed of his actual division. Sorry about that, SS Galician. But the national division of them is their ethnicity. And it was mostly staffed with volunteers from Galicia. I don't want to separate the Hutzels, Boykov, Lemkos, Padilians, Bukovinians, the Ukrainians of Komshchuna, Podlashi, and Volnaya, and eventually the Transcarpathians. All of them are you ready for this? Here's your nationality, Galicians. And have always been in the history of our people like-minded in the struggle for Ukraine's independence. Wait a minute. Okay, let's do the all stop, the show stops. Ukraine's independence. None of these regions were in Russia. They were in the Habsburg Empire. That was Ukraine, and that's where the actual political discussion about having a Ukraine. Ukraine, the word itself meant the borderland at that point. And they started borderland political parties. And believe it or not, the political party became a nationality. And maybe I'll get into that another day, how that started. But this man hated the people that were in the body of what is now called Ukraine, because they were Russian and they spent so much time killing them. Remember, 5.6 million people in World War II isn't the number that died in the war. It's the number that the Ukrainians from Galicia murdered. And the leaders were actually put on trial for this, and I'll get to that. Now, we talked about World War I, and it didn't work out for them. So the German Empire fell apart. Okay, they were getting funds together to do a new push and try to take over this area called Ukraine, but it fell apart. Flash forward, a decade. Now we're into the beginning of the Nazi Party. Well, the Bandera were already formed, and they were going to school in Germany to learn intelligence, to learn how to make bombs, to do sabotage, to do everything. That's how long Germany was planning to invade the Soviet Union. That's how long. In 1933, 1934, Stepan Bandera's group was already in Germany learning these things. And then, in the years before Barbarossa, they started going into the regions of what's now Ukraine and finding people that would support them. So they started setting up sabotage groups. They started setting up intelligence groups, so they could report back to the Germans, find out Soviet Army strengths and weaknesses. Where can we attack from? What are the best routes? What are the obstacles? The Ukrainians today say they didn't get into World War II until after Operation Barbarossa. At the same time that Germany was doing this, they were planning the attack on Poland. Now, we all know about that, right? Germany and the Soviet Union did that. Well, guess who else was there? The Ukrainians from Galicia actually went in and they did the intelligence ahead of time. They set up sabotage groups ahead of time. They also went in with Germany inside the South Army and did the actual attacks on Poland. At the same time, we go ahead a little bit further. Now, we have Operation Barbarossa going on. They set up in what was called special police, okay? We also call them gendarmes, behind the front lines going across Ukraine. And there were over 100,000 of these. And after the war, after the Nuremberg trials, there was an appendage trials. One of them was for the Ukrainian Holocaust. You never heard of that, did you? Well, after going through investigating and prosecuting Nuremberg, which was the Holocaust camps, where all those Jews died, right? You'd think the investigators would have been hardened to the tragedy because, you know, humans, emotionally, you have to a little bit. Because you have to do that work. You're getting emotionally scarred from seeing what the Nazis did to these people, all these people, not just the Jews. And then it hits you. These were the Ukrainians that did this. 100,000 of them that were in the gendarme, plus close to 500,000 of them that were just volunteering to do it. They just followed them around and they did it. The horror in the judgment from that trial, one of the statements said, you know, we give 1 million people as a number, but it's only a number because the human mind cannot comprehend anything over that. Like I said, it was 5.6 million. But they said, take that 1 million number, divide it by 100,000, the number of people doing this. Now take that into, let's say there's the average family has 10 people in it. They would have had to gone out 100,000 times. I'm sorry, that's the actual statement. They would have had to gone out 100,000 times to kill a family of 10 each time. That was the savagery. And a lot of it was done, and this is part of what really blew them away, was done with garden tools. The Ukrainians did it with pitchforks, axes, grass knives, scythes. They didn't have guns. And Ukrainian political philosophy, it followed the esoteric fascism of Evola. And politically, they were charged with killing, in a way, finding new ways to kill people that went way beyond anything they'd seen before. That was being a hero inside their politic and being a Ukrainian. That's what made a Ukrainian hero. So you're inventing new and brutal ways to murder people. And that's what these investigators were faced with. That's what they saw in their investigations that just totally threw them because they'd never heard of this type of brutality before. Now, let's go back to the actual Holocaust itself. It started with Operation Reinhard. Operation Reinhard was the actual beginning of the murders. Well, when the Germans started it, they brought in their own soldiers. But their own soldiers couldn't do it because they're soldiers. They fight in battles and they fight other soldiers. But the German army at that point, and even afterwards, they never got involved with it. They got psychological problems right away because, you know, that they set them out to do one or two mass killings, shooting people. They couldn't do it. They refused. They told the Ukrainians to do it. The Ukrainians jumped right up, volunteered, and they were thrilled to be able to do that. Now, what are we talking about here? Okay, well, they killed some people, right? Well, no. One day they killed 14,000. The next day, second day into the operation, they killed 27,000. The third day into the operation, they killed, God knows, it was something, they upped it again into the 30,000. Then they had a bad day and it was only 14,000 again. And that's when they started thinking, well, we have to do something else now because this is going too slow. I know. Gas chambers. We'll do gas chambers. That'll do it. Well, these people doing it, the Ukrainians were called the Troniki men. And the Troniki men were the people that powered the death camps. They were the actual death camp workers. They weren't guards there. They didn't have that responsibility. Their responsibility was killing people. That was their responsibility. So when the trains or trucks roll in and the people come in, their responsibility was getting them off, getting them to the gas chambers or whatever, however it was they were going to kill them. And for the ones that, you know, they didn't kill them right away, they tortured them and such. Dr. Mengele actually started out as a medic in one of these battalions. He was a medic. Now, all of the Holocaust was done by this same group of people. There were 100 to 200 Troniki men at every camp. Well, how many camps were there? I mean, how many could there be? Well, there are camps and there are camps. You have famous ones like Auschwitz, but you also have small ones, very small ones. You have transit camps. All told, and it's not a solid number, by the way, and I'm not going to say it is, but from the literature that I've read, there were up to 12,000 of these camps. And they did various functions. The transit camps were, you know, you have prisoners going to Auschwitz, you need to, they're classed differently, maybe political prisoners, so you want to interrogate them before they get there. And so you have tiny camp enclaves. One of them wasn't found until the 1970s. No one, they forgot about it. The only reason why they found the camp was because they started building an airport and they found the mass graves. No one even knew about those. This was very common in Germany, Poland, etc. Now, why haven't you heard about this before? Why hasn't anyone told you about this before? It should be a movie, right? Well, you've seen the movies. Have you seen Schindler's List? Have you seen The Boy in the Striped Pajamas? How about The Pianist? In real terms, all the people brutalizing the other people were Ukrainians. In Warsaw and Krakow, they were the special police. They were the SS battalions doing it. They were supervising the work. They were brutalizing the people. You've already seen them. They just weren't named. When you watch Schindler's List again, I think it will really change your world. That camp at Krakow, the commander there actually told the Ukrainians to think of even more new and brutal ways to kill people, because that was an interest of his. It was a hobby. And that's what they did. That's what they did. So we have this going through World War II. Well, why weren't they tried? At the time, nobody understood nationalism for what it was, other than Adolf Hitler in Japan. Nobody did. You know, how could you? Why would you? I'm going to get into this a lot deeper after the break. This is George Eliason with TNT Radio, and I'll be right back.
What happened to equity? Poor families with smart meters will now be paid not to use electricity to reduce the risk of blackouts. Yes, you heard that right.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
In England, the company responsible for keeping the lights on is working to establish a scheme to pay consumers with smart meters to ration their energy usage voluntarily. The company claims it believes this could be a cheaper and greener option than paying fossil fuel power plants to generate more electricity. So it has come to this. Our elite leaders in large corporations who fly around in private jets are now paying poor people not to use energy instead of allowing more energy production. This is the world of a Green New Deal on steroids, a world which we must reject. For the Morano Minute, this is Mark Morano on TNT Radio.
A man's home is his castle, but his men's shed, that's his kingdom. There are now more than 1,000 men's sheds across Australia, and they're more than just a shed. You can make things, grow things, find a mate, be a mate, shoulder to shoulder. The Australian Men's Shed Association can help to find a shed near you.
There's something for you at the Men's Shed.
Democracy in Action. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
This is TNT Talk Radio. I'm your host, George Eliason. Welcome back. Now, we're getting into a lot of very, very deep history here. So, we find out that it was actually Ukrainians that were from the Habsburg Empire in Galicia to the Russians in what's now Ukraine. Why weren't they caught? After World War II, now you had the Nuremberg trials, and I talked to you about the special add-on trial of the special police. Now, they did try it, but here's the problem. How do you put 100,000 or 200,000 or 300,000 or 400,000 people in jail on death sentences right then? They're just coming out of World War II. How do you do that? What they did was take the German control officers that were over them, and they tried them, and they judged them, and they killed them. And that's what they did. And they let all these people go free. These people ended up in the displaced person camps, and in a lot of cases, in their formations. So you know, imagine you have an entire army division of rabid Nazis in a camp. And you, okay, well, we got to let them go. Well, all right. Well, we'll let them move to Canada. Oh, okay. And that's what happened. Another division, which is, you know, I talked about SS Galician. They went to the UK. They were actually offered land to farm on. And you had the main Bandera. They went to the United States in their formations. Now, directly after World War II, the Cold War started. And so they thought, you know, the UK and the US thought, well, these are the same people, right? So they'll have insights into the Soviet Union because they're the same people, right? No, these guys, the only time they ever spent any time on Russian soil was attacking it. But they didn't say that. Yeah, we'll give you, you know, a lot of insight. but you got to let us teach our people Ukrainian nationalism. And guess what? That's been festering on U.S., Canadian, U.K., and even Australian soil all that time. When Ukraine moved out of the Soviet Union, these people for, you know, 60 years prior to that, at the beginning of the Cold War, formed the Ukrainian government in exile. It was formed by SS Galician and nationalist battalions that had killed 5.6 million of the people that they wanted to rule and they claimed to be leaders of. In 1991, when Ukraine seceded from the Soviet Union, they didn't want to recognize Ukraine because Ukraine was too Soviet. They hadn't had any time to be able to nationalize anybody. You think of it this way, that the one thing that a nationalist hates is a Bolshevik socialist. And the people out of coming out of Ukraine, that's basically what they knew because that's the government they had for 70 years. Now, they had to recognize them because the U.S. did. So the president in exile of Ukraine went to the first president elected in the new Ukraine and gave him the symbols of state, which is the flag, that trident, and the powers of state of the Ukrainian government in a contract. The new Ukraine in Ukraine had to form a nationalist government based on the form of government that the nationalists had already decided on, which was ultra-nationalist and hates the people that live there. They got a great start. Now, when this happened, the government in Ukraine did that. Well, why? The first president of Ukraine's family was a Bandera. That's where he came from, Galicia. And a lot of the government, they did too. Now, when Ukraine freed up, if we go back to World War II for one more second, this will make sense. In 1941, Stepan Bandera and his second in charge, Yaroslav Stetsko, declared a state. And Hitler promptly said, no, there's never been a Ukraine in existence, and we're not starting another one now. Well, it slept all that time. In 1959, Bandera was assassinated. Stetsko took over. In 1986, Stetsko died, and his wife, who helped him plan the pogroms in World War II, took over the OUN Bandera nationalist worldwide. In 1991 or two, she went to Ukraine and she got elected into the Rada. The government of Ukraine did not hold up its end of the bargain, so they had the Orange Revolution trying to build up a nationalist fervor in the country. That didn't work out well. The president in exile moved to Ukraine, and he and Slava Stetsko took over the youth groups even. Ukrainian scouting from that point on became the breeding ground for Maidan in 2014. Now, when Stetsko first came into the country, she started her political party called the Congress of Ukrainian Nationalists. And she started a militant wing called Tribes of Bandera. Now, you might be familiar with this name from Maidan. He's a leader of the neo-Nazis that did all the violence. His name is Dmitry Yarosh. He was her bodyguard, and that's where he learned his politics. Another part of her group in Trisub, the regional leader, was another guy that you are familiar with today. His name is Andrei Belitsky. He founded Azov Battalion. He was a regional leader for her militant wing of the party. He is a real Nazi, both of these men. So we have Nazis in Ukraine. Trizub and Dmitry Yarosh control the national security apparatus, the SBU, which is equivalent to the FBI and CIA, etc. Azov Battalion controls law enforcement from underneath, the police, from regional down to local police is Azov. They control the entire security apparatus of Ukraine. Well, you say, oh my, oh my. What about the politicians, those poor guys, lost souls and all? Well, when you look back at the Orange Revolution, there's Slava Stetsko, hand in hand with Peter Poroshenko, Viktor Yushchenko, and every name you know in Ukrainian politics. She taught them her form of government, and they've been building all this time to get here. So when you look at Yats is absolutely no different than Tymoshenko or Timoshenko or Yushchenko or Poroshenko or Nalivaychenko. All of these people were taught by Slava Stetsko. Now, another note, when she came back, an American Ukrainian diaspora prince went back with her. His name was Roman Zvarych. He was her partner in the political party. When Maidan happened, he became the press secretary for Azov Battalion for Andrei Belitsky. And he was the guy that raised the money for them and got them buildings to have their headquarters in. The Ukrainian diaspora worldwide are what's supporting these people. So now we have World War II Nazis in World War II, and then they go dormant. And then the next generation is literally World War II Nazis in 1991 Kiev, starting over again. It's like Hitler had a clone and they woke up in 1991, picked up where he left off. This is exactly what happened in Ukraine. And that's why George Bush's Chicken Kiev speech ran the way it did. He would not turn over Ukraine to a group of rabid nationalists. Well, no, he lost the next election, and Bill Clinton did it for him. These people are tied to the biggest, most powerful lobby in America, which is the Ukrainian Congressional Committee of America. If you're familiar with Alexander Chalupa or Andrea Chalupa, how about the Vindman? They're all part of this. Joe Biden is tied into them. Hillary Clinton is tied into them. Most of the Democratic Party and some of the Republican Party in the US are tied very strongly into them. They're enthralled with the idea of taking this worldwide in the West, this form of government, change it to the taste of your country a little bit so it's acceptable, and you can get there. And that's exactly what's going on. One of the ways that they do this, and Slava Stetsko bragged about this, her diaspora could deliver 5 states in a national election. And kids, she said this over 20 years ago. They can do a lot more than that because they have block votes. They have all, most of the other diasporas underneath them that go wherever the Ukrainians want them to politically, because the Ukrainians get the most support. We've got to drop off here. I'm George Eliason. Thanks for listening. This is TNT Talk Radio.